scheme and the whole setup of Cohn-Sham DFT within the LDA approximation. So the important thing is that it's all based on, can everyone see this? Okay. Yeah. It's all based on that there's an exact energy functional. This part, T plus VE, is the so-called universal Hohenberg-Cohn functional. But it, you know, we know it's in there. It's kinetic energy and the interactions. It's universal just because it's made of the kinetic energy and the interactions. Universal just means it's independent of what external V of R you choose. So why is N not an operator here? Just super easy question. This is just a function null of N. So this we're not doing. This isn't the Hamiltonian, right? This is just the energy. This comes from thinking about, you know, putting wave functions around the Hamiltonian, but somehow already having found the correct ground state wave function for this density. That's that Levy-Leib construction. So you can say, let's do a search over all wave functions that have the target density, you know, be it the ground state density or not. And then you can find that minimizing wave function, put it around T, put it around VEE. That's that idea of this universal part. We could do that work separately and then find this F for all densities and then just add this on at the end. Okay, so that's some background. We can, the Cohn-Sham scheme is that you introduce this Cohn-Sham system and then you write the energy as follows, involving some quantities now involving the non-interacting Cohn-Sham system. So this is a definition of EHXC. Okay, so importantly, so what we've done is we've said most of the kinetic energy comes from the Cohn-Sham system. And then importantly, but basically this defines EHXC, okay? And it's just sort of the thing that collects everything that we're missing here, right? And so that's that. So this is a definition of EHXC. Right, so that's what I was going to say is that we don't get the energy from the Cohn-Sham system, right? We make the Cohn-Sham system as a scaffolding to get a density in some practical way, to get realistic densities, and to get a large part of the kinetic energy. We never expect, even in the exact scheme, in the sense of if we do some small system and we carry out every step completely numerically exactly, we never expect this to be the exact kinetic energy. That's never the goal. It's just this is supposed to be a big chunk so that we don't have as much here that we need to approximate. If we make some errors here, there'll be a relatively small part of the total error. So then we take these functional derivatives. This is the key thing because this idea of taking these functional derivatives is what links up approximations to this guy to approximations for these potentials that we can use to solve and get realistic densities. Take this functional derivative. Now we're thinking in this case of, we could leave this general, but we're thinking of a particular ground state density from a particular V, so it's better to be that concrete, I think. And by definition, the derivative of TS, by the fact that this thing is defined to have the its ground state to have this density n naught, because it's minimizing condition, the derivative of TS is negative VS. The only definition here is that this piece is defined to be this thing we call VHXC. And then we get V of R because explicitly it depends on the density. This term depends on the density, so we get V of R. So that tells us that VS is related back to the original V by way of VHXC. So VHXC is the shift, this global shift in the original potential that gives us, that basically builds in some sense it's like a mean field, right? So it builds in the interaction effects and also effects having to do with the fact that the kinetic energy is slightly different, these kind of things. Good question. All right, so T is just defined to be, it's from this Levy-Leib construction. You say, let me propose a candidate ground state density, or let me just put the ground state density for this guy, say, in there. and then search over all wave functions until I find the one that minimizes T plus VE for that density, and then take that wave function and just compute its kinetic energy, that interacting wave function. That's T. TS is the same thing, but where you do the same game just in a non-interacting system world. So you again say, let's constrain the density to be this input density, the one that's going to be our ground state density. And then again, let's search over all wave functions that minimize TS for that density, but without interactions. Just minimize TS. Don't minimize TS, T plus VEE. Right? So it's a different search. But in this one, we can just do by just solving. We have techniques for solving non-interacting systems, right? We know how to do that. You just solve for single particle levels, and then you just fill the lowest levels. So there, we don't have to do a search. We just solve level by level the way you usually solve non-interacting systems, and then you get a kinetic energy for that system. It's just different. These are just different, always, even if you could do everything exactly. But fortunately, this is a big part of that. And that's the sort of the genius of the Cohen-Sham construction, is that this having this non-interacting system around does a lot of the work for you. It does two jobs, remember. It gives you this, so it gives you a big chunk of this, so that what remains to be approximated is relatively small. You know, the errors, it brings on these errors, and it gives you some concrete way of obtaining densities, realistic densities, that you can plug back into the functional that you've approximated, so you can try to get good energies. All right. That's half the review. Okay, so just to emphasize a few points, EHXC is the total, right, not sort of local. You can make a local approximation for it, but the real EHXC is the total difference between the F part, i.e. the not potential part of the interacting, I'll make this more concrete, interacting and Cohen-Sham systems, okay? So more directly, that's what EHXC is. So what I mean by total, or sort of global, is that you take the total T plus VEE for the interacting system, assuming you've already found it somehow, and you subtract off just this, what the kind of the F part, the non-potential part, so all that's there in the non-interacting Cohen-Sham system is TS. Subtract that off, that defines EHXC. The reason I'm emphasizing that it's the total is that in LDA, which is sort of the most important approximation in the sense of it's sort of the first and still one of the best, that what you do is you say, well, it's some global, non-local kind of quantity, but we're going to patch it together out of a similar quantity, or the same quantity, really, for a series of uniform gases. So someone solved a series of different density uniform gases having the particular kind of interactions that we're interested in studying, so namely 3D Coulomb interactions, right? But if you go and study a different class of interactions, like let's say you go to 2D or something, you have to remake the LDA. You have to do this whole calculation again. Someone has to do that one time very accurately. So you just say, maybe instead of it being this total global difference of all of this minus that, you just say, let's just go take these local differences. So yesterday I messed up a bit. I wrote capital E. This should be lowercase e, emphasizing that this is like a energy density, right? Because you're going to integrate this and get a total energy difference. And then similarly, by using these exact definitions on the left board, we get an approximation right away for VHXC, this, again, not potentially very non-local functional, as just a local derivative of this uniform gas energy, okay. I think there may be a units problem here. This may need to be defined as the energy per particle. So let me do that instead. So let me put univar, and then this is now energy per particle, so that this comes out correctly. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Let me fudge on this for a second. So we can work this out later. It's gonna be tricky for me to work out in real time. But basically, let's hide that under this approximation. But okay. So basically, morally, you take a derivative of this thing, right? So this is something you can do numerically. I'll show you a picture. So you can fit this thing numerically to some function, some explicit function, and then you can actually take this derivative. Yep.
So C is very small compared to T, as I understand.
So I'm not saying that EHXC is small. I'm just saying that if you peel off large chunks of the energy, we'll see. I'll show you a plot right now of it, of EXC, actually, without the H, because the H is rather big. Or you can actually see these are the potentials for a specific 1D example, and you can see that the Hartree potential, at least, this is the negative of it, this green dashed line, is quite large. Let me show you, this is the actual 3D with real Coulomb interactions fit of the exchange correlation energy. So this is just, the black thing is EXC, and this is as a function of density. And then I've also shown some pieces. So there's EX, which is large, and then EC, which is a lot smaller, but very, very important, right? So all the, to the LDA level, this all the, real correlation interaction effects that kind of go beyond Hartree-Fock and all of that sort of thing. So one thing you'll hear sometimes when people teach DFT is they might offhandedly say that EXC is small. And as you can see, it's not particularly small, right? I mean, EC is small, but EXC is not so small. But what they really mean is that you know, if you make errors in it, first of all, you make errors both in EX and EC because people approximate them together in this LDA setup. They've just found that works better. And those errors tend to cancel, is the common wisdom. Also, you've already peeled off really, really large pieces of the energy, like TS. So whatever errors you make in EXC, they'll be relatively smaller compared to the total energy. That's sort of part of the idea, too. So you could try to throw everything in. You could try to throw in TS and all that. It's just that then whatever errors you make are just going to, you know, just be compounding here. At least we want to pull off some big pieces. That's the philosophy. Some of this is just empiricism that people have tried different ways of doing it and found this works the best. Finally, Cohn-Sham algorithm. So Cohn-Sham algorithm, I wrote it out in sort of more steps yesterday, but I want to write a really brief version so it's a little bit clearer. So you solve some particular ith Cohn-Sham system. And we'll look at some Cohn-Sham systems. Actually, let me go back to this first slide again, because it's a nice example of an exact calculation. This is exact, by the way. This isn't an LDA calculation. So this is for a real 1D system of four interacting electrons in some potential, in this black potential. Okay. You solve a Cohn-Sham system for this thing. So that means, in this case, the Cohn-Sham system is actually the non-interacting system with this red potential. That's the final one. That's the converged exact one that has the exact same density as what's on top, which came from an interacting system calculation directly. Here you solve some ith one, which is not quite yet that red Cohn-Sham potential. It's some candidate one that's close to it that we have just guessed or maybe have obtained by some number of iterations. From this, this ith Cohn-Sham system is defined by a Cohn-Sham potential VSI of R. That gives you some ith Slater determinant wave function. So people talk about the orbitals. You get a set of orbitals. So often when people write out the Cohn-Sham equations, they write a separate Schrodinger equation for each orbital. Here I'm just thinking of the whole set. And you get some ith candidate density, ground state density, which may or may not be the right one. And by the way, I'm describing this in some exact setup. So if you do this with the exact functional, which you can do actually for small systems like these 1D systems, this really will converge to the exact ground state density. In fact, it's been proved. Then you update the Cohn-Sham potential by reaching into this oracle called VHXC. So it's something you construct. Remember, I described this table that you could pre-construct. So you just reach for this thing. You say, here's the candidate density in I, plug it into this black box that you can somehow construct within different approximations, but it otherwise is some funny algorithmic black box. It tells you how much to correct the external potential, this sort of bare external potential, to simulate the effect of having interactions, which the coincidence system does not, but this sort of simulates that effect, to give you some potential that you can then put back in here and solve again and get a different density. So the next thing we'll talk about after the slideshow is, why do you get a different density when you go back and forth between these two loops? Because it seems a little bit circular, right? Like, why don't you just get back the same coincidence potential that you started with and get the same density? It's not so clear the way I wrote it, so we'll make that more clear. And step infinity, once the density stops changing and you said, okay, things seem to have converged, you obtain the ground state energy via plugging it back into the energy functional. Again, you don't obtain it from the Cohen-Sham system directly, but you do obtain some important pieces. And I'll show you some data. I mean, you're asking about TS. I'll show you some data on these slides too about how close TS comes. This comes from the orbitals. So TS, you get it by taking these orbitals and actually computing the sum of each one of their kinetic energies. There's this all-important EHXC part, which yesterday we talked about breaking that up into EH and EXC, but that was just to be more honest with you about how people really construct these things. And it would just be problematic to include EH, but it's conceptually simpler just to leave them together. And this is the key thing that you approximate, say, by LDA. Finally, there's, of course, the potential energy. Hope you can see that. That's just V of R, N of R. That's it. So importantly, you know, you obtain the ground state energy by the whole job of this loop essentially is to give you two things. It's to give you TS and to give you some final density that then you can plug in here and here. And then that's how you get a very accurate energy, which is one of the most important outputs. And remember that if you're kind of a formal lattice model type thinking person, you might think, oh, you know, what is the energy? It's sort of only defined up to a constant shift and blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, in these realistic systems where people can really use very realistic Hamiltonians, very realistic sets of orbitals and things, the energy is an extremely useful quantity, right? It can give you information about, you know, phonons, and give information about lattice structures, crystal structures, all kinds of things, right? So you can get tons and tons of useful information out of having accurate energies. Very important. You're asking how do you start the algorithm?
Yeah, because the first step should be to if you have a Hamiltonian, okay, the first step should be to obtain a Cohen-Sham system for it.
Right. So this part is not as hard as you might think. So you just have to have almost any sort of sensible starting point is fine. So a sensible starting point, for instance, could just be to just turn off the interactions and then use the original potential, but just ignoring the interactions totally or something, and solve that system. You'll get a density that has the right number of particles. It'll have reasonably okay shape and everything, and just start with that, right? Or, you know, do a Hartree-Fock calculation, something like this. So there you include interactions at some mean field level, fine. You know, and just get a density that way. Well, you won't get a potential that way, but I mean, you could then easily construct a potential, non-interacting potential that has that density by just solving a non-interacting system a few times just to try to get them to be consistent and then go from there, say. You know, you could just do different things. Well, actually, you don't need the first potential. You could just start with the density here from a Hartree-Fock calculation and just immediately go to this step, plug it in, and then you'll get a density, and then you can start going around and around. You know, there's all these sort of rather reasonable ways. In fact, as we talked about yesterday a little bit at the end of class when there were some questions, the Hartree-Fock density in some cases might be closer to the right one than the LDA density in certain cases. But an important outcome of that discussion about why would you need this to get the density is that this is an exact algorithm, right? So Hartree-Fock is sort of forever stuck at some mean field level. This is not. So this is, you'll get a mean field quality density, say, if you use LDA. You might get a better one, but you may not. But if you use better approximations, there's these ones that actually mix LDA with some amount of Hartree-Fock, right? Here you don't do Hartree-Fock calculations, but you could, and you can mix the results together. And this has actually been formally justified theoretically to do this. And you can use that as your approximation, and that's this thing called hybrid functional. And that will give you potentially better densities than a straight Hartree-Fock calculation, and so on and so forth. And then you can go up this ladder of better and better functionals that people are constructing and could construct in the future. And then the better and better functionals we make, the closer and closer these densities will get to the exact one and may far outstrip Hartree-Fock in the end. Does this answer your question? I mean, you're just worried about how do you start? Can you say your question a different way? I mean, do you still have the question? So basically what I'm saying is it doesn't matter too much how you start. You can start from any reasonable density that has the right number of particles and is sort of reasonably the right shape. And then this thing is smart and will give you a better... Basically, I mentioned yesterday that there's this damping you have to do when you have two densities. You might want to mix them together. But other than that, this thing is very smart, actually, and it will point you toward a better potential when there's actually some rigorous proof now of this that's very recent. So you can actually show that somehow this thing, in the space of all densities, it actually somehow points you, it gives you an arrow pointing to the real ground state density. And then you just follow this arrow at some kind of gradient descent type of thing.
You can't use this to get correlation functions beyond, like, you know, what's already contained within the density.
That's okay, good question. So the question is, what can you obtain, say, beyond the density and the energy? That's the topic of today after we go through the slides on some level. Like, we're going to focus on one thing that people try to get, which is the gap, and see what kind of goes wrong there, what goes right, what goes wrong. Basically, you can't get, practically, you can't get things beyond the density and the energy if you're a very formal thinking person, right? Practically, you can say that there's a functional for every possible quantity that you could get from the ground state wave function. But in practice, these have not been all been constructed so well. I mean, you know, there's not very, very good approximations, say, for correlation functions or for entanglement entropy or all these other things that you might get from wave functions. You know, this is some missing work that maybe is just sitting there for some smart person to do. So I'd encourage you guys to think about this. But basically what you get is energy and density. But part of it is that, you know, the community that has been using this is rather happy in many cases with getting energies. You can do a lot of things with energies, right? And then I'll show you some phonon results in one of these slides. And you can see there's extensions where you imagine doing linear response on DFT calculations, and you can get a lot of things. So you kind of do multiple DFT calculations. You get multiple sets of energies or corrections to energies, and you can learn a lot.
How do you find n from the given quantum system?
That's just a matter of solving a non-interacting problem. So that's why when I wrote out the Cohen-Sham equations yesterday, so if you look in your notes from yesterday, I wrote a little Schrodinger equation for each orbital. So you simply forget that you're solving an n-particle system, and you take this potential, you attach the kinetic energy operator, you solve the Schrodinger equation without interactions for one particle. You know, then you find all the single particle eigenstates, and you just fill the n lowest states.
Equation.
Of course, yeah, that's right. It's not, you know, so easy, but we can do it, right?
Numerically.
Yeah, just do it numerically. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, people are discussing things called orbital-free DFTs, where you can skip that part, where you just skip over solving a non-interacting system, which, again, we can do it numerically. We have ways, right? But it's expensive, you know, somewhat expensive. It's one of the most expensive steps, like maybe the most expensive step of this whole proposal. The nice thing about it is you get TS, so it's hard to give this up, right? You know, you have to work very hard to, if you want to throw away the orbitals, you won't get this, so you have to get it some other way, directly from a density. So there's a lot of interesting theoretical work going into how can you write down integrals and things involving densities, and you can actually get reasonably good energies and things. And this is, you know, where you skip over having orbitals.
HXC using the right part of the board.
Sorry?
After we found the density, do we compute VHXC using the right part?
Correct. So you have a candidate density. So here you'd put NI in this thing, and then you would, well, in here. And then you would simply evaluate. There's some formula that one of the most often cited ones is this one by Perdue and Wang from 1992. You can go look at this paper in PRB and just look at the formula. It's not so complicated. It's just some polynomial times the log of, with another polynomial inside with some explicit parameters and things that it just have some numbers in a table that they just fit, right? And then they get this black curve. Actually, they get the red curve. And so they took a numerical derivative of this thing, or an analytical derivative, actually, and then plug in those same coefficients. And then you just take your candidate potential and just feed it into this thing at every point and read off some potential. What you read off is something that looks like this blue dashed curve. And then you compute your Hartree potential, which is just convolution of your candidate density times your interaction. You add these two together. This is a negative of the Hartree, by the way, so it'll be positive. So you take this big positive mound or whatever that has not that many wiggles in it. You add this blue thing, which is negative, they cancel to some degree, and you get this red potential, which, if everything was exact, would give you back the same density once you solved a non-interacting problem in that red potential.
Yeah. Okay.
Fine. Question about the algorithm. So, what was your question still?
Yeah. So we are looking. I understood that we are computing HXC using our density and using the right part. And now I'm a bit confused that if we have our trial density, okay? So, for example, T and TS entering the EHXC, okay? So, which is on the right part of the board, we have T and TS, okay? So, do we have to substitute the same density for them?
I don't understand. Is the question you said?
So
T and TS enter EHXC.
We decided
the difference between them enters EHXC.
We decided that we have found some density, okay,
mm-hmm.
and we have to compute V for it, okay.
Right.
VHXC for it, okay. So we are computing it using the expression for EHXC.
Right. Well, you compute it. You compute EHXC from this expression. You take the kernel of it. This core thing that you're integrating with, you take its derivative to get an explicit formula for VHXC that's constructed locally at every point. This is the engine that drives that algorithm. So for every density we plug it in here, we get a VHXC. We add that back to our external potential, which never changes. Get a new cone-chain potential. That part is a little non-trivial. Why do we get a new cone-chain potential? I was going to tell you guys a brief bit about that in a minute. So let's try to go on for time's sake. And then you solve it again by filling up non-interacting single particle levels that you obtain from VS, and then this gives you again a new density, go around and around. And this will converge if you damp it correctly. So hold on to those questions and we'll talk some more about it. And so this is what it looks like when all the dust settles, if you could do everything exactly, just to give you guys a feeling for the sizes and shapes of these things, and just to give you a sense that there really is somewhere out there for these systems in practice always, a real cone-chain potential. So there really is some non-interacting potential that looks like this red curve, that if you can solve a non-interacting problem in it or an interacting problem in the black curve, you really will get the exact same density. That's the idea. Yes?
That is also a question. So it means that we have to compute EHXC as a function of the density, OK?
Right. You have to compute EHXC at the end. You don't need to compute it on every step. You could, but you don't need to, because it's just its job is to give you an energy. And you don't trust that energy until the density has converged to something that you believe is close to the right one. So its main job during the algorithm is to be the thing, be this curve that you take a derivative of that tells you how much to correct the potential at every point. This comes more or less from its definition and from the fact that you're minimizing things. You compute it by quoting this curve. So you take the density at each point, and you slide along this curve. So you go to point, let's say you go to a position called R1. You measure the density at R1. You go and you find it has some value of 0.1. And you take that number and you look on here. And then you go and get this value. That's your result. And then you do it again at R2, R3, R4, all these positions in a continuous fashion. And at each point, you get some value sliding up and down along this curve. So as the density becomes high, you get less correction. As the density becomes low, you get more correction. And then you so on and so forth, and you just slide back and forth along this curve going down the line of your density, and you just add them all up. That's EHXC. You do a similar thing to get VHXC. This is how it has a particular shape, because you're sliding up and down along this curve. But it's not this curve, it's the derivative of this curve. That's it. All right. So again, for the sake of time, we'll need to go on. So here is now a 3D result. So here is a 1D result, which is nice, because it has some more structure, and you can see the density. I'm sorry, we're going to have to just go on. We can talk after class, but we need to cover some more material. So this is the exact density for this 1D system and these potentials. I'm not showing the density here, but this is for a real 3D helium atom. And people use quantum chemistry methods, like exact more or less methods, to solve for its real density, what not shown. And from that, you can construct the actual cone-chain potential for this real 3D helium atom, which is quite interesting, right? And there, all you do is you solve a non-interacting problem over and over and over again in an iterative fashion, and just keep guessing and checking your potential, your non-interacting potential, just in some loop, until you find that it gives the same density. And that's easy to do. You just solve a series of non-interacting problems very quickly. But that what's deep about this is that once you have found that it matches the helium atom density, that's it. The Hohenberg-Cohn theorem tells you you're done. That's the only potential. Once you found it, there's only one, right, non-interacting problem that has that same density, which is a really neat result. This was done in 1994 by Umragar and Gans. Here is a different atom, and here's showing the radial density, you know, scaled by some factor to make it plottable or better plottable. This is of a 3D real neon atom. And this is the exact, the dark line, the solid line is the exact radial density. The dashed line is the LDA result. So I just wanted to show you guys some success stories of DFT to convince you that, you know, because sometimes people will kind of go scoff at DFT and they'll say, ah, mean field theory, right? Look at this result, right? I mean, this is amazing, right? This is very accurate. To drive home this, well, then to kind of, you know, show a few more warts, though, here's the VXC. Both computed from the, you know, the exact VXC, so it's just from the definitions, you just do subtractions and you can, you know, starting from the exact density and things, and you can compute the exact VXC. And then you can just run an LDA calculation and see what it converges to, and it converges to this dashed line. So, you know, there are some errors. I mean, you can see here that there are some slight deviations in the radial density for this case. Not all atoms come out this well. But then also to back up this claim I've been making that when you solve these Cohn-Sham systems that you get a big chunk of the energy pretty accurately. And again, it's not intended to be exact. That's not a, if it's not exact, that's not a failure of Cohn-Sham. It's just a feature that even if you do the exact Cohn-Sham system, it won't be the same, but the TS will be rather close to the T. And all the rest will be soaked up into the EC, basically. You can see for these three atoms, helium and beryllium and neon, that TS is really actually pretty close to T. So what that does is it takes pressure off of EC or EHXC. It doesn't have to be as accurate for the overall accuracy of the calculation to be good. That's the idea.
So if I want to put neon down there, E is the total energy like calculated, I guess, exactly.
Calculated exactly.
Where's the total energy calculated by DFT?
Not shown in this. So this is not a... this is the point. This is not a approximate. There's nothing approximate here. So this is not an LDA table or anything. So this is really where someone took the exact density and then so-called did an inversion where you do this loop of guessing and checking a bunch of non-interacting systems until that non-interacting system has the same density, the Cohn-Sham system. So there was no LDA, no approximations. That's right. Well, so yeah, so this non-interacting system has the same density, and so it's the Cohn-Sham system. It's the only one. It's the unique, exact Cohn-Sham system, which you never reach in a practical calculation, but in these little toy calculations you can. And then you simply take the Slater determinant of that thing, compute its kinetic energy, and that's TS. So it's this chart is showing you if you could do DFT exactly and get and reach the real Cohn-Sham system, which for these small systems they can, you know, how close would you get? And the answer is that you would get this close, pretty close. It's not supposed to be the same, but the idea is it's supposed to take pressure off the approximations by having this big piece in hand. Right, so for real condensed matter systems, you could never, in practice, construct the exact Cohn-Sham system, right? Unless you had a really, really accurate density somehow. Okay, so now real 3D, you know, extended system, meaning, you know, real condensed matter system result. So this is an infinite, you know, system. I guess molybdenum selenide would be the name for it. And the black lines are an LDA band structure calculation. So this is what I was going to try to tell you guys, is that you'll go to talks and you'll see people flashing band structures, right? So what are these band structures? These are the single particle energies of the Cohn-Sham system once it's gotten self-consistent, right? So you get some approximate VS, and you compute its single particle energies, and you plot them versus momentum, and you get these band structures. And then what's interesting is that there's this experiment called ARPIS where people actually eject electrons. And you can theoretically show that the energies you get correspond to basically properties involving the single particle Green function, which in the non-interacting limit should be the same as the band. These energies should be coming from the band structure. But now this isn't an interacting system, so there's no theorem exactly that tells you that these have to match. But there is this Landau-Fermi liquid picture. And if you kind of invoke that, you should argue that for a weakly correlated system that these could match. And then they do in this case.
Going back to something you said a couple minutes ago.
Sure.
Is there any reason, is the reason why we wouldn't expect to get to the exact one for a big system Is that just because there's like a lot of different attractors near it that you might fall into instead of?
Okay, I like this question. So the question, right, is do we not reach the exact density you mean, or the exact Cohn-Sham system because of getting stuck in some local minimum? That's really not, no, that's not the problem. It's just that the space we're doing the search in is the wrong space. So the local minimum in the LDA is just in a different place in density space from the real exact functional. So it really is just that LDA is not exact. It's this isn't true.
Unless we knew the answer, we'd never find the exact one.
That's right. Yeah, but what's interesting, and this isn't always appreciated, is that if something else can just hand you the exact density, which they're in 1D, using DMRG, that's how we got those results for that 1D system, say, or for like 3D atoms where you have fancy quantum chemistry solvers and things where they can basically do exact diagonalization with the real 3D orbitals and things, then you actually can have this density that you can be sure is the right one, you know, up to tiny, tiny errors. And then it's very easy, in fact, to construct the Cohn-Sham system if you have the right density. You just solve non-interacting problems, you know, 10 times or something until they match. And then you know, you can read off all kinds of things, TS and all that, for free. But, you know, in real systems, we can't get the, you know, the exact density anyway. So we do this. What's amazing is that this gives you pretty close without ever touching an interacting wave function. And that's why there's now open source packages that just let you dial in real systems. Like, you can literally go download codes where you could plug in, you know, this chemical formula and then tell it what the experimental structure, lattice structure is, say, and then you could get this band structure and compare to these experiments. You know. This one is really nice. So this is something that's beyond ground state DFT, but not far beyond, where basically people, if you look at this paper, I encourage you to look at it, because I'm not going to be able to explain in great depth how these calculations are done. But essentially, people work out very complicated formulas about linear response. So what if you move the positions of the atoms in this Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and then ask kind of what's the linear response of like the energy and other quantities? But then in the end, you work through all this formalism, and in the end, you have a few quantities that you need to calculate, you find, and you calculate these using ground state. They're ground state quantities, right? This is the idea of linear response, is that you know, out of equilibrium kind of quantities can be related back to ground state quantities. So you calculate all those ground state quantities using energies obtained from DFT, using like, say, LDA. Then you plug them back into this complicated machinery. You get a phonon spectrum, right? So this has to do with vibrations of the lattice. And then you actually compare it to experiments, and the agreement is beautiful. And again, right, so DFT is criticized, and rightly so, as a uncontrolled approximation. Now, there's work afoot to make it controlled, but right now it's basically uncontrolled. So it's a bit philosophical. When it works, you know, what do you learn? And my philosophy a little bit is that you can use LDA, say, as a definition of what weakly correlated is in some sense. So if LDA works, it's weakly correlated. I mean, this is just some everyday kind of definition you could say. And so what you've learned here in some sense is not the phonon spectrum, which we already knew from experiment, but you've just learned that the system is weakly correlated. But it's still very deep that you can get theory to agree this well. All right. So any questions about these plots? Going back through them for these charts. Great. Okay, for the sake of time, I'm going to skip for now this thing I was going to do. Maybe I'll do it at the end for those interested about why does the Cohn-Sham algorithm advance? I mean, there's already enough information to see that, but it's not so obvious as written. So why do you get a new VS? We'll talk about that at the end if there's time. I wanted to quickly go through a story about what I would call Cohn-Sham system observables. So these are, the question is, what can you get from the Cohn-Sham system? Right, so in a sense, all you can get is TS and the density, but you know, people want more. right? So they always want more. So what can you get and what can you trust? Okay, so again, cone-sham system is this set of single particle orbitals that you can summarize by writing phi. You know, it's some approximate, say for instance, we could get it from the LDA. And so we don't have the cone-sham system, but we have a pretty good proxy for it. And from this, we can get a candidate density, some LDA level quality density, which might be close to the real one, the real ground state. We get the kinetic energy-ish, the cone-sham kinetic energy. Say with an LDA. Okay, and we know that the ground state energy is a really useful thing to have. We get that, you know, of course, from okay, so we can approximate the ground state energy. We can get a lot of things. But there's other things that people try to get. And it's a bit of an open question about whether these are justified. So so some things that people observe is that, and I'm going to talk much more about this in a second, that the band gap, I'm going to define all this a little more carefully, the band gap can be close to the real charge gap of the interacting system. Other things, just to tell you guys what people do, is they, as we saw, the bands themselves may correspond to certain, you know, photo emission experiments. I'm not going to include like that phonon calculation in this, because what I'm talking about is people trying to reach into the cone-sham system and get stuff, right? So that was a very well-justified calculation, that phonon calculation, because there you're getting energies, right? You're basing things on energies. And that is really fine. That's the job of DFT, is to give you a good ground state energy. And in that, it succeeds pretty well in many cases. And we understand why it succeeds. So that's fine, right? But these are where you're reaching inside the band structure of this cone-sham system and trying to learn more about your interacting system. And you know, that's really opening up some black box that you're not really supposed to look inside.
So when you say band gap, you mean I'm going to take my current Shannon non-interacting system and look at the lowest energy excitation, lowest positive excitation, and I'm going to claim that this energy is the same as the difference between ground state and present state excitation.
Right. So there'll be bands, and these will be filled, and there'll be one that's the highest energy filled. And you just look at the difference between that and the lowest energy unfilled guy. Yeah, this is the band gap. So I was going to define this more carefully, but you're right. It's good to explain in passing.
What's the charge gap?
What's the question?
What is the charge gap?
I'll define that in a second. That's what we're going to come back to. I mean, it's a good question, but I'll tell you much more about it. And finally, transport. Not finally, but just the last one I'm going to mention. There's many others that people try to calculate. So they look at the single particle Green function, for instance. So this is, say, phi psi dagger they look at this correlator for different values of R and R prime. And from this, you can argue that certain transport properties about, you know, whether the system conducts and things like this can be ascertained if this was like the real wave function. So people say, well, let's use the cone-sham wave function. But remember, that's not the job of the cone-sham system to have a good wave function. It's only got like two jobs, right? To have sort of a big chunk of the kinetic energy. It's not supposed to have the right one, just a big chunk of it. And more importantly, even it's supposed to have a good density, the right density, in fact. But people, you know, look inside the box, right? They want to know if they can get more for the same price. So there's one fact that I'm not going to go into, but you can actually prove that the position of this level, that if you take this band structure from this Cone-Sham system, and you fill all the levels, that this highest occupied level corresponds to, well, actually, it's not exactly this level, but basically, it's the difference between this and the energy of the neutral system, that this corresponds to, or this equals the real value. So. So this thing called Koopman's theorem. So I'm not going to prove that today, but there's this interesting fact that I encourage you guys to go look up. But that's not enough, unfortunately, to get this gap, because the gap involves both the position of this level and the position of that level. So now let's talk about the gaps.
Like the filling factor of my system, and I say, okay, you know, like there's arguments you can make about when you must have a conductor, right? If you have like a even number of bands, or like two times the number of bands in terms of the number of electrons, then you might have initially, you might have a band initially.
That's what I was going to talk about exactly.
Oh,
yeah, good question. So it's just asking about these kind of, you know, this non-interacting picture of band filling and even an odd number of electrons. Let's talk about that exact thing. All right, so for most of the rest of the time today, and this is, I wanted to go through this a bit of this story about band gaps, partly because it's a good thing to learn about how do people define these gaps. And what we're going to focus on next week is lattice models. Lattice models are an attempt to understand effects of interactions better. So we want to bring down the cost of calculations or the complexity of the model and somehow keep the essential piece that is describing what interactions do and how electron correlations arise. And that's because partly to address some of these failures of DFT. So partly to address, well, okay, again, saying failure of DFT is a bit strong, because we'll see what that means. In some sense, the Cone-Sham system not giving you these things is not a failure. That's an important thing. So sometimes people unfairly criticize DFT because they'll say that the Cone-Sham system, oh, you know, the band gap is wrong. The bands don't match perfectly. The transport comes out funny, you know. But this isn't a failure of DFT. This is, all these things are uncontrolled approximations, very uncontrolled. So this is important for you to know if you're going to work in this field. So that, but I'm going to put a question mark, because we may start knocking these off one by one. So we may find theorems that say, in these, under these conditions for this quantity and this or that quantity, that maybe you can get the transport from certain quantities involving the Cone-Sham system under certain circumstances, or maybe other things involving. We know you can't get the gap, actually. This is something we know. But and I'll tell you a bit about why that is. But this would be nice for more work to happen along these lines of finding out more and more and more useful things we can learn from the Cone-Sham system. So so one of the kind of notorious supposed failures of the Cone-Sham system is about getting the charge gap. So let's talk about what that is. I'll say some words about why it's important. So you basically think about a grand canonical ensemble system. So let's think in that picture, where we don't forcibly set the particle number of our system, but we put a chemical potential into the Hamiltonian, and then when we solve it, we just let the particle number come out as whatever gives us the lowest ground state energy. So here's the chemical potential, right? So this determines the average number of particles in our system. And then this is going to be a double y-axis. So it's either going to be the total energy or the number of particles. And this is the total energy without the mu part included. Okay. So this is just this is like we put in mu, we solve to sort of obtain some wave function that has some fixed number of particles. When then we evaluate the energy, I'm thinking about, we don't count the mu part as part of the energy. It was just a Lagrange multiplier that we used to sort of set the particle number. But then we take that wave function and we wrap it around all the other parts of the Hamiltonian that are sort of, you know, really there, or the parts that we're interested in. So kinetic energy and interactions and potential, right? And what we find is that these quantities vary smoothly, but then at some point, not always, but in systems that are gapped, that a plateau will develop. And then eventually at some other value of mu, it'll, things will change smoothly again. right? So basically, at some point, and as we vary mu, the system will not respond to changing mu. So we want to push some particles in. That's what mu will do. It'll say, here, you know, I'll give you some more particles for free. I'll go ahead and save you this energy, and you're allowed to have more particles, and I'll deduct the energy cost of that for you. That's kind of what mu is doing, right? It's sort of giving like a tax refund or something, or sort of some deduction, right? And so, but at some point, the system says, you know, I can't take more particles right now unless you give me a much bigger savings, right? You have to save me way more energy for me to accept more particles. Somehow, a cost develops for the system to accept more particles. It can't do it, right? And that's this thing called the gap. Okay, and again, I haven't referred to bands, right? Because this is a statement about interacting systems, which could be very far from a band theory picture. There may not be any notion of bands in this system. Maybe there is, and the Cohen-Chen system gives us some nice way of, in a sense, defining bands for interacting systems, but there may not really be a meaningful sense. And so these two positions, these two different mu's, we can call them mu minus and mu plus, and I've drawn that arrow indicating what the gap is, and it's the difference between mu minus and mu plus. So it's just the window in which the system won't respond even when you try to shove more particles into it. Okay, and this is an important quantity for applications. So people are interested in this for the production of LEDs, for photovoltaics. And say heat resistance. Of transistors, say, other things. So you could get a very sweet job at Intel if you could solve this problem, because they would love to know much more information about particular, you know, you take silicon or something and you dope it, and then you want to ask about gaps and things. They would love to have this information very accurately, but they have to settle for less quality information. They actually have a DFT division, so they actually, at Intel, you can get a job running DFT calculations. So if you understand all this theory very well, you could do well there, say, for a career. I mean, this is actually something that people do. You know, knowing the gap is important in LEDs because electrons will move across the gap and some light will fly out, and people want to be able to make this light of different colors very precisely. It'd be very nice. You know, right now they have to do things like mix different color LEDs together, put them close together, and then when the light comes out, it blends and you get a different color. But they'd like to just engineer this. So photovoltaics, you could, you know, solve global warming or something, right? If you could engineer a material where it would respond at visible light energies and then generate an electrical current very efficiently. So if we knew all these things, we could do a lot. So this is why, you know, DFT and things get a lot of funding, right? Because it's very, very useful stuff. Okay, so let's think about how do you really calculate the gap. So the thing is, DFT actually does let you calculate the gap. So we talked briefly about how people calculate phonon spectra, but they do this by doing, say, multiple DFT calculations to get sets of energies, things like that. You can also do this for the gap. So DFT does give you the gap, formally speaking. All right, let's see why. So how do we define mu plus? Let's think about this, right? So let's think about now, in a canonical ensemble setup, right? So this is canonical, meaning we fix the particle number externally. That energy, that canonical energy with n plus one particles, but where you basically say we're going to tune mu plus up till we save this energy, we kind of deduct this energy cost of having this extra particle. That should equal the case where if we just had n particles, and had the same mu. Let me say this better. So the idea is that at some point, we're going to tune mu until the energy cost for having n or n plus 1 particles balances, right? So either we could have an extra particle, which costs us some energy here, but we save it with mu plus, or we could not have that particle. We don't pay the cost. We don't get the savings. So at some point, they're in perfect balance with each other. So that's when we're right on that upper cusp where we move off the plateau. For any mu above that value, it turns out to be a better strategy to just pay this cost and take the savings, right? That's the idea, right? So then if you just solve this very simple algebra, you find that mu plus is E n plus 1 minus E n. This whole board is not about DFT, right? This is something you guys can use if you're doing other calculations of gaps, say, to understand how people do them. Okay. Also, you can do the same kind of thing for mu minus. So again, these equations just define some tipping point where we try to encourage the system to have fewer particles by raising the cost of having particles, right? So we lower mu down to some mu minus, and then at some point, it's a better strategy for the system to just eject a particle than to hold on to one, because we're sort of penalizing this thing, right? So we find that tipping point defines mu minus to be en minus 1. Okay, and then therefore, by definition, the gap we said was the difference between these guys. So it's e n plus 1. If you work it through, minus 2 e n plus e n minus 1. Right, so you say this, and then here you get this has a negative. This has a negative, so you get 2 e n's. This one flips sign around. Interestingly, look at this formula. If you think about it, it looks like a discretized second derivative. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. So that means that constant shifts in energy, overall constants, will subtract through. This will not see them. Also, linear costs in energy with the number of particles will not be seen. So if you have some overall mu on your system, that'll cancel through this formula. So only kind of quadratic and higher type corrections to the energy will come in here. So this gives you a feeling about, you know, interactions are like that, right? Interactions are sort of an n squared effect, where if you have, you kind of sum over, you know, your particle number twice. So this is sensitive to things like that. So, you know, a gap can open. It's also sensitive to discontinuities in the energy as well, right? So there can be discontinuities in the energy where if we have bands, so in a non-interacting picture, and we add particles, the energy changes by tiny amounts. You know, we add a particle. In the limit of large systems, these are spaced very closely. The energy doesn't change much. Then at some point, a band fills. And then we add one more particle, and boom, the energy jumps, right? This will also see that. So this will see quadratic effects in energy, and it will see discontinuities. I'm just saying this intuitively so you can think about how gaps arise, right? So they arise from non-interacting effects involving periodic potentials and also interactions. Okay, it's that interaction part that's the kicker for DFT. That's what it has trouble with. So it has no problem with these band effects. Let's talk about that a bit. Well, okay, but before that, let's just say, you know, culturally and what do people do? So people don't try to get the gap this way in DFT, and there's sort of two reasons. One is that it's inconvenient to get the gap this way, meaning by doing three ground state calculations, right? This is three calculations in the canonical setup. So the thing is, DFT is an exact theorem, is an exact theory. You can get the exact ground state energy in principle from it. So if we can just make better and better functionals, we can get energies. We can do three DFT calculations, and we can get the gap. And we can solve problems of LEDs and photovoltaics and things. Well, N comes for free. So we know from chemistry the electrons come with the atoms, and we know how many electrons go in a particular chemical material.
Right, so yeah.
Right, so we start from a charge-neutral system. That's N. And we just do a regular DFT calculation. These are the kind people always do. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have, no, this, yeah, you don't have to have full bands. I'm not saying there has to be a gap, and I'm not saying bands have to be full.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to think about. Well, do you have a question?
There was a related question. I was wondering which end we were referring to, especially
oh, yeah.
The gap. Is it the gap for N?
Right, what is N? So N, I mean, a good, very good question. I should have been clearer. That N, I mean, is the you know, neutrality number of particles. I mean, there may be other situations where you want to calculate gaps with some overall chemical potential shift. So maybe the system might be on some substrate, some, you know, that might have some charging effects, some backgate energy or something in a real setup. So you may want to calculate other gaps at other positions in the spectrum. But I'm just thinking here of like an isolated system where you know the number of particles that go in just from chemistry. So you think about stretching all the atoms to the atomic limit, and then you just bring them all together, and you're just constructing this material in empty space, you know. And then this just tells you some chemically determined number of electrons in the total system, you know, ab initio. And then you imagine adding a particle, removing a particle from that. So hopefully that, does that make sense? There can be, again, other values of n you might want to work around, but here we're just thinking about this kind of neutral value. So again, you could do three DFT calculations, get three energies, do this formula, and you could get a gap. But there's kind of two reasons why this isn't done that much. One is that it's practically difficult. So people work in these setups where they use periodic boundary conditions and some unit cell, and it's not so easy to add one particle and kind of figure out where did it go. You know, periodic boundary conditions. Ideally, you'd like to do a finite, say, open boundary system, and then you can really sensibly add one particle, but this is a very expensive calculation. But there's an even more important reason, which is that in LDA, and I can tell you why, we may have to go on Monday about this a little bit, but basically there's a collapsing effect, it's called delocalization error, where even if you could do this calculation, or even if you do this calculation in LDA, the gap you would get from this formula collapses to this spacing in the Cohn-Sham system for reasons having to do with failures of LDA. So then you're totally dependent on this gap being there, and then whether that gap is there ultimately comes down just to whether you have an even or an odd number of particles in the unit cell, which isn't the whole story, right? That's this part of the story, but it misses this part of the story, the interaction part. So maybe I can give an executive summary of that last bit. I was going to go in some more depth, but we're running out of time. So let me just say that in a very quick, brief kind of cartoon level. This story about, out of board here. That's true. Yeah, okay. Thanks. All right. So just to, I ran out of time, unfortunately, because this is a neat story to think through more carefully. But let me just give you the quick summary. So you can make systems that, let's just think of a very 1D toy world, and we'll be more precise on Monday, and we're going to construct some lattice models for such systems. Let's think of a 1D toy system where you have two wells spaced very closely, and then a big spacing, maybe with a big potential hill here. Two wells again in a big spacing, and so on. And then we just put, for every well, we just put an electron. And these are, importantly, these are electrons of spin, and this is why this even odd counting goes the way it does. Okay, that's one side. Let's also think about a system where we have just equally spaced wells, and we put one electron per well, and this is a spin unpolarized system. So we put in the same numbers as ups and downs, but one per well, right? So in this kind of pattern. Okay, so you should know from the basics of band theory that you have some bands, right? And you know, you might have many bands that are filled, but if you have two electrons per unit cell, then this means that in the totally non-interacting picture, you have a filled, your highest occupied band is completely filled, and all the ones below it are filled, right? So filled band setup. Okay. Over here, you know that in this non-interacting picture, you have a partially filled band. Right? So this is what you would say get if you did if you just brashly turned off the interactions and tried to just say, maybe the interactions don't matter at all. Let's just totally ignore them. This is what you would get. But the kind of quick and dirty story, I was going to go in more depth, but we're running short on time, is that this is what happens to the Cohn-Sham system. So you generate a Cohn-Sham system from these for these kinds of setups from doing this Cohn-Sham algorithm. So you don't touch the wave function, but you just go around this loop working with densities and Slater determinants. But in the end, you get some non-interacting system that is defined to have the same density as the real one, but it falls into one of these two categories, right? And what will happen is that this system generically will have a charge gap. If these are not at some equilibrium position, it can have a charge gap, especially if you think about taking these little molecules. So think about this as fixed, and think about this as variable. Okay. Then if we vary this, you know, I mean the same variable here everywhere. So I'm thinking about keeping these little molecules at a fixed distance here and varying this. Let's call this thing R. Same R here and everywhere. Okay. And if we just stretch the system out, eventually we're going to reach some limit where we just have isolated molecules. Okay. And it's pretty easy to see there's going to be a gap for them, right? Because these are finite size systems. Finite size systems always have a gap generically. Okay. I mean, maybe not if we fine tune them, but generically they will. So then as you bring them back together, that gap has to survive for a while. Okay. So there's going to be some gap eventually as we stretch. The point is that the gap can come from sort of two places. From this counting, and I'm thinking here of the Cohn-Sham gap, there'll be a filled band, so there'll be some Cohn-Sham gap, which is this arrow. And there's also going to be some effective interactions, right? So in the end, when you just plot the real gap of this kind of system, it'll look like this. And this is this stretching parameter R, where we go toward this molecular limit. This will be the exact one. And then the Cohn-Sham one will just be some fraction of it. And we've done calculations like this and seen it. And then the LDA will just be close to it. This is just a generic feature of the LDA, that the gap it gives via this exact formula always sort of collapses down to the Cohn-Sham gap, and we can talk about why. Over here, things are worse. So over here, again, let's imagine stretching. Now this will be our R. There's no other link scale. There's no fixed molecular link scale. Here we'll just have R, you know. And we're just going to stretch these guys out uniformly. Again, as we stretch them out uniformly, a gap will have to develop eventually in the atomic limit. Then as we bring them together, it's going to survive. Okay, so there's going to be some gap. And then, you know, it may close or become very small. In this case, it actually becomes very small. It doesn't completely close for technical 1D reasons. But what's interesting is that the Cohn-Sham system has 100% error. The Cohn-Sham gap never opens. There's never a gap from the Cohn-Sham level. But there is a gap if you could do an exact DFT calculation and get these three energies. So this is some kind of 100% level failure of this uncontrolled approximation of treating the Cohn-Sham gap as the exact one.
Cohn-Sham system.
Mm-hmm. So these bands I'm drawing, think of these bands as being if you look at the Cohn-Sham system after you've converged everything, you've constructed some approximate Cohn-Sham system, or maybe even the exact one using these tricks that you can do to construct the exact one. That's right.
And you talk about this exact gap that comes out because you're discretizing your momentum, the momentum eigenstate.
The exact gap comes out because of a combination of band filling and interaction effects, and you get it by. So really here, it's interaction effects. And that's really the point of this right half of the board, is that band filling effects alone don't cut it. They don't give you the right picture of where the gap is coming from. And so the idea is that the Cohn-Sham construction gives us a sensible way, and if you will, of turning off interactions. So sometimes people talk about what would happen to a system if you turned off the interactions. But what does that mean, turning off the interactions? Does that mean turning the interactions down lower and lower gradually and solving interacting systems along the way? Or what else could it mean? One thing it could mean is really just turning them off, slam off, but fixing the density to be the same. So adjusting the background potential to correct for that. That's the Cohn-Sham idea. And that gives you some picture of the sort of two origins of this charge gap. One is that you could have filled bands, right? The other one is that interactions could play a role. Here, you just don't have filled bands when you turn off interactions. You have a half-filled band because of this one electron per unit cell, and more generally, an odd number of electrons per unit cell. But in fact, when we do exact calculations, there is a gap. So this is just some kind of drastic failure, if you will, of this Cohn-Sham picture. It's not really a failure, because the Cohn-Sham system only had its only job was to give a density and be useful for getting energies when you plug the density back in. But people try to obtain the gap. And here, there's just the very serious failure mode of that kind of approximation. So this leads us now into the world of moderate to strong correlation effects. Okay, so that's where we're going to be going somewhat next week, and constructing lattice models to try to understand this physics better.
If I look at something like a law semi-metal, where like I have this, bands aren't completely filled, but that's not an effective counting, then if I turn on small interactions, will Cohn-Sham predict whether or not it has a charge gap?
So the question is about something like a semi-metal, like a vial semi-metal.
Yeah,
I think even a regular semi-metal is also fine in this picture. These have interactions, correct? You know, all systems do. Yeah. Will Cohen-Sham predict a gap? No, so it won't. And it, again, it's just.
I guess rather a semi-metal and a banded chelator.
Mm-hmm.
Will, if I have, well, I guess first question, I think if I have a non-interacting system, then Cohen-Sham does a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be able to tell whether when the charge gap.
Yeah, if you have a non-interacting system, then Cohen-Sham is exact.
Right. But if I have if I turn on some kind of interaction, will it still be able to pick up when the gap appears or not?
Yes, the Cohen-Sham approach will pick up qualitatively the appearance of band gaps. But even here, this is one of the points I wish I had a little more time to make, which is that this would be what you would get from the reading off the Cohen-Sham band gap in LDA. This is what you would get if you constructed the exact Cohen-Sham system. They're pretty close. But even the exact one won't give you the exact gap, because the exact gap always includes interaction effects and other things. This is just part of the gap forever. I mean, there's never going to be any functional anyone can construct that will give you, if you get the, if you try to obtain the gap simply by measuring the difference in these positions, you'll never get there. But there are functionals in the future that could be made where if you could do these three calculations, could get you closer and closer and closer ad infinitum to the real gap. So DFT can give you gaps, but it's not been a success so far, partly because people have been relying on this uncontrolled approach of simply treating the Cohen-Sham gap as the real one. And again, you're basically hoping or relying on the presence of filled bands, which you can just see there's got to be cases where the Cohen-Sham system is not going to help you at all. The gap is there, and the real thing can see it, the real calculation can see it, but the Cohen-Sham part of the calculation will play no role in this.
Can't see mod insulator at all.
Just this thing, right? This kind of story is called mod insulator physics, and we'll talk in more length next week about that. So we're done for today, but you guys are welcome to throw more questions my way.